Welcome back, everyone, to the XCast X-Files Podwatch, episode 74. And today we're having a look at Rush and the Goldberg variation. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, and I'm joined by Sarah Blair. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well for this time in the morning.
It's 4:30 in the morning where I am right now.
Yeah, it's not quite that bad here. But anyway, let's should we head straight into these ones, Sarah?
Let's do it.
Okay, so the first episode we're going to talk about is Rush. Both of these episodes actually were broadcast in December 99. I'd always assumed that Millennium was the last episode of 99 broadcast, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Anyway, this was Season 7, Episode 5, and it's written by David Amann and directed by Robert Lieberman. And this is the episode about a group of friends who have the ability to move faster than the eye can see. Well, Sarah, you mentioned to me that you'd been trying to get through a rewatch of this one for like a couple of weeks or something. Did you ever finally manage it?
I did last night. Well, I kind of skipped through the parts that I had already seen. So I think I saw the scene where they're looking at the evidence and they're going to the evidence locker when the evidence gets stolen. I saw that scene about three or four times. It's like, oh, yeah. It was not the most, I don't know, engaging episode.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, it just seems to me like you get to kind of this stage in the series and you start getting a few episodes which feel a bit tired. And I think about this time, you know, first time around, I was sort of wondering how much life the series had left in it. Yeah, I don't mind this episode by any means, but there's something kind of unengaging about it, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, I mean, they made a Carrie reference because obviously the parallels were very similar to the telepathic Carrie and all that kind of stuff, but it was like a really sorry attempt to try to play off of that theme, and it just didn't work for me. But I did like the teaser at the beginning. I thought that was really creepy and scary, so I liked that. But then what didn't work for me is it just, the speed thing was really, really cool. It was a great idea. I just don't think that they utilized it very well to its full potential. I think they focused more on, how should I put this? Like, they focused less on the fast ability and how cool that was, and more on like, oh, they're addicted to this thing. And it was more like treating it like a drug, which is really boring. Because, I mean, people take drugs and get high and do crazy things all the time. So why would you have this really cool thing in a cave and not try to explore that a little bit more and figure out why it's there and how and what? And Mulder just seemed really okay with the fact that they got rid of this crazy anomaly. He's like, yep, they just filled it up with concrete, so whatever. You know, like, as much as he pursues stuff in the rest of the series, it just didn't really fit with his character to just kind of seem like he was ready to let it go so easily.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know, it just feels like an episode to me which was kind of a draft or two away from being a lot more solid. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And, yeah.
I feel like that about a few Season 7 episodes where I'm kind of just a bit sad that they weren't a bit better. This feels like one to me which would have benefited as well from like the Vancouver atmosphere, where, you know, maybe it's not going to be the greatest story, but the setting would have added a bit more to it.
I definitely agree with that. And the rainy, creepy atmosphere of Vancouver definitely would have added to the, you know, maybe a throwback to one of the season one or season two episodes, or even, what is the name of the episode with the kids and the trees?
Yeah, well, actually, yeah, that's the one I was thinking of. That's called Schizogeny. And that's one that I think, actually, I like that one a bit more than most fans do.
I do too. I love that episode. I think it's great.
Yeah, because I just feel that, like, you know, you got the orchard setting is well used, and the whole episode's got like a texture and a mood that, yeah, if you put this one in season five, I feel you'd get closer to that, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely agree with that.
What about like the casting then? Because to be honest, none of these actors really stood out to me. I mean, none of them jumped out at me as particularly bad or anything. But there's nobody here that I, you know, really enjoyed the work of.
Yeah, same. The one guy looked like, I mean, he's 30 years old in high school, and that didn't work for me at all. But I mean, what are you going to do, I guess. I mean, I've seen theories that, oh yeah, advanced his age. I mean, I guess like meth does, but...
Yeah.
I think they could have done better to parallel the drug aspect of the whole thing. It just didn't quite... The connection just wasn't solid enough. And I don't know why they had to be so mean to that poor teacher.
You mean the guy who gets killed in the cafeteria?
That was pretty brutal.
That was brutal. And there's actually a couple of, like, pretty intense, like, set pieces. Like, that murder.
Mm-hmm.
And not just the fact that he's murdered, but he's kind of tormented.
Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, he wasn't exactly a nice guy, but, I mean, that was a little excessive for me.
Yeah, it was quite cruel. And I believe they actually toned down, like, a little bit of the violence in that scene. Like, at the behest of Fox or mm-hmm. Standards and Practices or whatever. And there's also, like, you know, there's quite a visceral car crash as well a bit earlier on.
Oh, yeah, so. yeah. So, and the getting beaten to a literal bloody pulp with a flashlight, that was rough, too. So I didn't totally get why this kid was just so... I guess it was the drug, quote drug, but that made him so brutal. And it was pretty, wasn't that far off from home as far as violence goes, I thought.
Yeah, it's definitely quite full on. And it's not necessarily one like you remember being particularly violent.
Yeah, I didn't know, huh? Yeah, I didn't remember it that way at all.
Yeah. One thing I find quite interesting is you got this thing running through it where, you know, Mulder and Scully are perceived as being, you know, how would you say it, kind of like out of touch and, you know, they're old by the kids, I mean.
Yeah. I did like Mulder's Nirvana reference.
Oh, that's right. Something about teen spirit.
Yeah. Smells like murder to me.
But like, actually, that all that stuff rang quite true to me, because like in a previous, you know, until fairly recently, I was a college teacher, and definitely had that feeling from like, you know, my mid-20s onwards, you know, where like cultural references change so quickly and language changes and stuff, and you just feel this disconnect between people who are, you know, teenagers or a few years younger than you. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if you've ever experienced that.
All the time. Especially when I'm writing, because I want to try to make sure I don't put references that'll make my books look too dated.
Yeah.
But I also want to be able to make, you know, connections that will not be so cliched either. So it's really tough to find a balance there, because I'm constantly wanting to make references to 90s stuff, like Clueless and that sort of thing. And it's like, wow, that hasn't been relevant for a long time.
Well, I've had like the opposite, where I'm trying to use like contemporary references, but failing. So like, uh-huh. I remember being in one class and sort of used the phrase Netflix and chill. And then very, very quickly became apparent it didn't mean what I thought it meant.
Oh dear.
So actually, all the stuff with like the uncool Mulder and Scully, I actually quite enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Maybe it could have been like more fully developed or used to a greater dramatic purpose. I don't know, but I still quite liked it.
Yeah, I always love the Mulder and Scully dynamic, no matter what episode it is. So that always works really well. They always do a great job.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting though, because like 2 or 3 years earlier, the series was like the height of cool. Obviously, at this point, it was still very popular and everything, but...
Yeah, it was on the way down, so yeah.
Kind of was on the wane in terms mm-hmm. of the ratings and everything, so maybe that means it's an appropriate time to you know, to portray them like this, I don't know.
Maybe.
I also felt there's a couple of moments where, like, the episode... I remember that sense being, like, a child or a teenager where, you know, where you're very bored and, like, time just seems to be dragging, you know. So like you say, it's not particularly subtle with like the parallels with drugs and all that, drug usage, but I thought at least it was an interesting like kernel of an idea anyway.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think like you said before, it just needed a couple of more drafts to really make it shine. It wasn't very polished. So, but and I feel that way a lot about all of season 7, or not all of it, but a good number of episodes just feel like they were at this point sort of starting to just halfway do it and phone things in and not really up to snuff. And I wonder how much that has to do with moving to LA and everybody sort of getting busy and starting to move on with their careers and that sort of thing. Move on. I think they sort of got the sense that things were starting to wane and they were on their way out and looking for the next thing. And I think that this season 7 is sort of where that comes into play a lot, because they don't really seem like they're into it as much as they were in, you know, 3 and 4.
Yeah, I think all those things you mentioned are like big factors. And it must just be hard. I mean, how many series have you seen when they get to like season 6, 7, 8? And
yeah, for sure.
It's very hard to maintain like standards, isn't it? I think.
Oh yeah, yeah. Especially with something that has to be so different and creative. I mean, there's only so many scary things you can do. You can't get ideas from anywhere, and they can't all be winners, and they can't all be super scary. And you know, it takes a lot to be that creative. I feel like not that sitcoms don't have to be creative, but when you've got a writer's room and you're all sitting together bouncing off ideas from each other, and you've got your characters and a certain tone for the show, it's a lot easier, I think, to get stuff churned out. And when you've got the X-Files, I'm sure they had, you know, planning meetings and everything, but then the individual writers had to go off and come up with these ideas and all that kind of stuff. So, and a lot of it was on Chris Carter too, so.
Yeah, and he was obviously working on like more than one series at a time by this stage as well, because, in season 7 he was working on this, and Millennium had finished, but Harsh Realm was a short-lived series he was working on. All right, so the Goldberg Variation is the 6th episode of the season. This one was written by Jeffrey Bell and directed by Thomas J. Wright, and this is the episode in which the agents investigate Henry Weems, a man who appears to be unbelievably lucky. So what did you think of this one, Sarah?
I really like this episode. I think it's fun and light, and it's one that I can watch with my kids, so
yes,
I appreciate that aspect of it. I really like the Goldberg machines and the Rube Goldberg stuff, and it's just a light, fun episode, and I really like how they played off Henry Weems' life and how it paralleled the Rube Goldberg, you know, situations, the murder, or not murders, but deaths and things like that. Were a lot of fun to see how they played that out.
Yeah, I like this one a lot too, actually. It feels like the kind of thing that, like, I don't really laugh out loud at it much, apart from one moment, which I'll mention in a minute. But it's kind of gentle. You kind of watch it with a smile on your face.
Exactly. And you don't get that from the X-Files a lot, but I feel like Just Sweat is kind of like that too. Even though it's got a little bit more of a darker tone to it. But yeah, it's one that's, it's not scary, but it still works as an X-File because it's strange and, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice and it's kind of undemanding and, sometimes that's welcome.
Exactly,
Yep. And before I forget, the moment I mentioned that I always laugh at is, it's the guy who's like, he seems to be the owner of like the convenience store, and it's when he says to Scully, it's after the guy's been run over, and Scully asks him what the guy said, and he was like, said his last words were, "Reese, I want you to have this." And Scully's like, "Mm-hmm." I just love the delivery there.
He does it so well. Yeah, I agree. That's really funny.
Yeah.
And I love, my favorite part is when Mulder falls through the floor.
Oh, when he's doing the tap or whatever.
Yeah.
The
plumbing. And it's like they go into ask about this guy, and she's like, "I just really need to get to work. Can you just please help me?" And he's like, "All right." Yeah. And then he ends up through the floor. He's like, yeah. That's so typical of Mulder. Like, he's got his best intentions, and he just, such a good metaphor for the whole series. He just falls through the floor so many times.
Yeah, because he's not the kind of hero that, he's not like James Bond or somebody who's always in the right place, or, you know, always knows exactly what to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
So there's some interesting casting in this one. So Henry Weems is played by Willie Garson, and he'd appeared previously in season 3 in The Walk. What did you think of him then? So he's obviously crucial to the success of this episode. How well did he do?
Really well. Yeah, he's like, I just want to win enough to help this kid. Like, I just really loved his kind of, not, he wasn't really like self-effacing, I guess, but, you know, he really played it off the character really well. Yeah, he had just the right amount of goofiness and really endearing character, I think. He made it, you know, he wasn't dumb. He was just like, I just have this thing I need to do, and I just need to do it. So, yeah, it worked. He played it just right. I think it easily could have gone the wrong way if anybody else had done it, but he had just the right amount of, you know, easygoing, like, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if the word schmuck is right exactly.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. But, yeah.
Yeah, he's like that. And yeah, it could easily have gone wrong. And the other notable bit of casting is, as the young boy, you've got a young Shia LaBeouf.
Mm-hmm. It's probably his best role.
I was going to say, he grows up to become arguably one of the most obnoxious actors of his generation.
Would it be rude to say this is the height of his career? I don't know. Yeah. But he's cute. There's been so many guest stars to be on the X-Files before they were famous, you know? So this is one of those times where you see where he went, and yeah.
All right. So apparently this was one that, when they made it, this episode came in a bit short in terms of running time. So some of the stuff you see are like reshoots that they went and had to go back and do to pad it out a bit. So, like, you know, you mentioned like the Goldberg machines, the Rube Goldberg machines. I really like the fact you get to have a good look at them.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently those are kind of inserts to help the running time, basically. Some of them, anyway. I've always wanted something like that in my bedroom, to be honest.
Me too. And did you ever play that game Mousetrap?
Yes.
I loved that game. I was so obsessed with that game. And I never could get mine to work just right. The basket always would get stuck.
Yeah.
Drove me crazy.
It kind of seemed to come apart a bit.
Yeah.
Played it for a few minutes. Yeah. So there were a couple of points where I felt like it did feel a touch padded. Like the teaser sequence is like 5 minutes long. I kind of felt it took a while to get to the point. Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that you hear quite a bit about episodes that go over time, but this is one that came in under.
And in a way, I can appreciate that, because it's just a very simple story. So I can understand why they got through it really fast, because they didn't need that much to keep it solid. So as far as runtime goes, I can see why they might have to pad it out, because it's just a straightforward storyline and there's just not a whole lot to it. It's like, this guy just needs to win some money and, you know, there you go. So, but it's all centered around, you know, the machines and that kind of stuff. So as far as story goes, it was just a good little story, which I appreciate.
Yeah, the other, like, minor quibble I had is, you know, like, the scenes with the deaths. So, like, I'm thinking of when the mobster comes in and he ends up getting trapped in the ceiling fan. Like, I get what they were going for there, but I think that if this episode was, like, to be a classic, those scenes would need to, like, really kind of make you gasp at, like, their ingenuity.
Yeah.
Whereas here, like, the editing's quite choppy. You get what's happening. But what would be really good is if you had some, I don't know, if the director was like a real visual stylist, those scenes would kind of amaze you, I think. And they'd be like really intricate and stuff. But I didn't quite get that sense here.
I wonder how much of that is writing and how much of it is directing, or both. Like, it has to make sense. And because it wasn't really a supernatural type thing. They really did make it more of a coincidence where, like, everything really did have to, because I guess the Rube Goldberg machines are based in, like, solid physics. So the physics actually had to work, even though it was extraordinary, it wasn't supernatural. So I guess that was a little bit difficult to work around.
Well, I think what I want is probably very difficult to achieve on, like, a TV schedule, you know? Just the last thing I was going to mention is this period of the season, there's kind of a fan theory that this was the season of secret sex. I don't know if you've ever heard that before. And what it's based on is that after the Millennium Kiss, in episodes like Rush and the Goldberg Variation, if you look at like Mulder and Scully's body language and the way they greet each other and stuff like that, they seem a lot more warmer, a lot warmer and yeah. more open with each other. And so the fan theory is that after Millennium, they'd started sleeping together. And I just wondered if you'd like heard that or if you had any like thoughts on
well,
it.
Well, as a shipper, obviously, yeah. I mean,
you considered it at length.
Well, I mean, in my opinion, they've been at it for a lot longer, but in my personal imagination,
yeah,
they've been at it since, you know, early on.
The pilot.
Basically. It didn't stop with the bathrobe, okay? No. No, yeah, like, I definitely noticed that, and especially they're a lot more touchy-feely, and, like, in Hollywood AD, the end, they hold hands, and they're just a lot more relaxed around each other, which definitely sort of backs that theory up, for sure. And I felt like they've been going at it at least since Memento Mori.
I don't know, because, I mean, in The Rain King, she is talking to the woman in the bathroom and she says, it sounds like she said they've never even kissed, you know, but that she could be lying or they could have been having sex, but not
yeah.
kissing, you know, you never know.
I think it's a big fat lie. And I think it's Chris Carter sticking to his platonic guns.
Yeah.
Despite and in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. He's just in denial.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Carl. It's always fun talking to you.
Always a pleasure, Sarah. Always. Tomorrow on the podcast, it's Orison and the amazing Malini. In the meantime, find us in the usual places. We're on Twitter at @X_cast. If you search for XCast on Facebook, you'll find our page and our group. But until next time, listeners, trust no one.